Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just when you thought it couldn't get much worse for retailers, the holiday shopping season took a horrifically tragic turn today. Just outside the New York borough of Queens, a worker at a Walmart store died in a stampeding crush of pre-dawn shoppers. And a deadly shooting at a Toys R Us store here in California has further marred the formal kickoff to this anxiously awaited holiday shopping season. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at splendidtable.org. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal on this Friday, the 28th of November. Thanks for joining us. It's been a tragic start to an already troubled holiday shopping season. Here in California, two people dead, shoppers scrambling for cover as shots rang out at a toy store in the Palm Springs area. And a tragic stampede left one dead and four others injured at a Long Island Walmart. There's a strange irony there in that retailers began this day worried they wouldn't see enough customer interest this season. Yes, the usual bargain-hunting crowds turned out at stores across the country, but analysts are already reporting the bag count is down. Read that, we're not buying as much as last year. As Ashley Milne-Tite reports, this year Black Friday could take its name from the mood of consumers who feel they can't spend money they don't have.
The mood outside Bloomingdale's is merry. The store itself is bustling, but not packed, despite evidence of discounts everywhere. Long Island resident John Fletcher just took advantage of a 50% off deal on sweaters. He and his wife Cindy both noticed something about the sales floor.
It really wasn't crowded at all for Black Friday.
The item I bought, I walked up to pay, and I was the only person paying. Nobody was buying. There were lots of people in there, and this was the lower level. Crowded as could be, nobody buying anything.
Alston Jones is buying. He works for a medical manufacturing company. He's keeping up that time-honored Black Friday tradition, splurging on yourself.
I bought like a vest. It was probably $170, and, you know, like some pullovers and stuff like that.
He used his Bloomingdale's credit card to pay, but he didn't load it up with everything he wanted. He was eyeing a pair of jeans.
But I tell myself, do I really need the jeans? You know, it's $270-something. I could, like, wait. I have other jeans. So if you don't need it, you don't have to stretch yourself.
Jones says times are tight for his family in the Caribbean right now, so he's sending them more money than usual. Stephen Platt of the Platt Retail Institute says this weekend is unlikely to produce stellar sales, and he says that's bad news for the rest of the holiday shopping season.
If you're a retailer sitting there with a lot of inventory, what are you going to do? You're going to lower your prices through more promotions in a desperate attempt to get more traffic and more top-line sales. The problem is, so is everybody else. And so it just creates a huge profit loss spiral.
He says plenty of retailers will file for bankruptcy in the new year. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
One of the few bright spots today was in the sharply lower cost of getting to the stores. Just a few months ago, the price of oil hit a record high of $147 a barrel. Today, around $52. While that's good news for most of us, it's not making the OPEC nations so joyful. The global cartel is meeting in Cairo tomorrow to figure out how to get oil prices back up. To do that, many experts expect OPEC leaders will decree another production cut. But good luck enforcing it, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Oil has lost nearly two-thirds of its value in the last few months. That has OPEC members like Venezuela calling for the cartel to cut production by a million barrels a day to try to boost prices. But even that probably won't make a difference, says Barbara Shook with the Energy Intelligence Group.
Demand has just fallen off so much. OPEC really can't do anything that's going to affect the market significantly.
Shook points out that OPEC has recently cut production by about 2 million barrels a day, and oil prices have continued to drop. But even if OPEC tells its members to scale back production, they probably won't, says Nick McGregor, an oil analyst with Redmayne Bentley.
They all say we'll cut production by X amount, but there's no guarantee they'll actually do it. There is a lot of cheating goes on, and the temptation to pump a few extra barrels and make a few extra bucks is always there.
McGregor says low oil prices are especially hard on countries like Venezuela and Iran. Those poorer OPEC members will often sell as much oil as they need to shore up their balance sheets. In fact, backdoor dealing has become such a norm that OPEC has come to rely on so-called data trackers to figure out how much oil its members are actually producing. The Financial Times' Carola Hoyos is in Cairo for the OPEC meeting.
OPEC uses data collectors, and these data collectors use a network of spies who look through binoculars and count tankers that go in and out of big ports, and that's how they find out how much is being produced.
OPEC is expected to announce any possible production cuts this weekend. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
A new law may force American companies to make safer chemicals, but the change, if it comes, isn't because of any crackdown by the U.S. government. Chemical companies that sell to the European market are rushing to meet a deadline this weekend. That's when they have to pre-register under a sweeping law called REACH. It stands for Registration, Evaluation, and Authorization of Chemicals. As Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, this is a case where globalization might force American companies to clean up their act here at home.
The idea behind REACH is to force chemical companies to prove their products are safe. 30,000 different chemicals are in products used in Europe. Over the next decade, this law will require their makers to fork over detailed data about those chemicals and their toxicity. Richard Dennison at the Environmental Defense Fund says for years, European regulators had to prove a chemical unsafe in order to ban it.
This is unlike the way we regulate pesticides and drugs, for example, where the burden of proof is squarely on the industry. And what REACH would do is to extend that same type of system to chemicals used in everyday consumer products and in industry itself.
And that means American exporters will have to reveal product and safety data they've long resisted giving their own government, says Mark Shapiro, author of Exposed.
I think they've resisted doing it because they've taken an approach of, trust us, we know what we're doing, and we can make the determination as to what is and what is not safe.
Environmental activists have listed over 200 chemicals they want regulated. They include substances like phthalates, which are widely used in plastics but are linked to birth defects, and formaldehyde, often found in plywood but linked to cancer. Some retailers are beginning to shy away from suspect chemicals for fear of liability. Multinationals like DuPont and Dow are already experimenting with less toxic alternatives. Still, Walter Van Hethoff at Dow Chemical warns.
Sometimes it is that the alternatives are not available yet, or that they don't work as well as, you know, the existing substances.
Other smaller companies may choose to opt out of the European market entirely, since the cost of compliance could undermine their profits. Joe Acker heads a trade group representing 300 mostly smaller chemical makers.
I've had at least a dozen companies come up to me and say that they were not going to register.
Author Mark Shapiro says some companies may end up pulling products from Europe that they'll continue selling here. That's partly why critics are urging Congress to strengthen U.S. chemical regulations.
If the United States does not keep up with what the European Union is doing now, what's going to happen is we are going to become the dumping ground for products that are banned in Europe.
Shapiro says that's already the case with some products, including plywood containing formaldehyde. But changes may be afoot. On Tuesday, the EPA announced 5 public hearings to investigate formaldehyde emissions from pressed wood products that are currently allowed. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wall Street kept up the rally today, but those retail sales worries kept it from going very far. The details when we do the numbers. Imagine a city that decides to part ways with its polluting past. A city where green jobs are created for its poorest residents, all working together to save the environment. No, this isn't some feel-good scene out of the 1970s where everybody breaks into a chorus of "I can see clearly now, the smog is gone." It's pretty much the plan Los Angeles is laying out for itself with a series of new green building codes. Here's the story from Rob Schmitz of KQED.
Three stories below downtown Los Angeles, cars descend into the West Coast's oldest underground parking garage. The city built the Pershing Square Garage in the 1950s when energy was abundant and cheap. City of LA's Dan Eason shows off a relic from that period.
We're headed down into some of the exhaust fan rooms right now.
Eason walks down a stairway to inspect a 10-foot turbine. It's a box fan on steroids, an energy-gobbling monster.
When these were built, the technology that was available is what you currently see. You know, turn them on, let them exhaust.
This old clunker will be among the first things replaced if LA approves an ordinance to make hundreds of city-owned buildings more energy efficient. Nancy Sutley is the LA Deputy Mayor for Energy and Environment.
We have a history here in Los Angeles of pushing the environmental envelope.
Okay, stop laughing. She's serious. Earlier this year, the city famous for its smog became the first big city in the country to require all new large commercial buildings to meet strict environmental standards. Those same standards are part of the plan to retrofit 500 of the city's oldest structures to use less electricity. It's all part of LA's goal to reduce greenhouse gases by 35% from 1990 levels over the next 20 years. LA's targeting buildings because they account for almost half of all greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. Sutley says one of the goals is to serve as a model for the private sector.
It's going to be difficult.
Economist Jack Kaiser of the LA County Economic Development Corporation says the cost of green retrofits could give many building owners pause.
The next 2 years are going to be very rough for the economy. They will pay attention, but it's not something that they're going to jump into immediately.
But a slow economy doesn't seem to be stopping LA's clean air goals, goals that will require a lot of work. To do the retrofits, LA plans to create up to 500 so-called green-collar jobs, union jobs that'll include revamping lighting systems, putting up solar panels, installing low-flow toilets to save water. The city plans to recruit these workers from LA neighborhoods with high unemployment. This is all good news for electricians standing outside their union's dispatch hall in South LA waiting to be called up for a job. A slump in home and commercial construction means rising unemployment. International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Kevin Norton says LA's retrofit program is part of a new green economy he hopes will spur job growth.
We definitely need to be on the forefront of new technologies because that will be a tremendous amount of work in the future.
LA City Council plans to vote on the retrofit program later this fall. In the meantime, Norton says, his members will have to settle for the only economic sector that's hiring more of his workers these days, the industrial sector. Why? Because of a construction boom in oil refineries. In Los Angeles, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
As we noted up top, today's big business story here is retail, retail, retail. It kind of led yesterday's news, too, along with the ongoing terror siege in the financial capital of India, Mumbai. But earlier in the week, if you can think back that far, there was a whole lot going on domestically. For the weekly wrap on finance news, we turn to New York Times columnist David Leonhardt and Megan McArdle, who writes for The Atlantic. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay, we've called on the two of you because you cover the intersection between politics and the economy, and this week was political. President-elect Obama officially named his top economic advisors. Let's start with you, David. You wrote your column this week on Larry Summers. He was appointed the head of the National Economic Council. I take it you think Mr. Summers is going to be a formidable force.
I do. He's sort of been the indispensable Democratic economist over the past couple of years. After he was forced out as the president of Harvard, he really carved out a role for himself in which he became something of a shadow Democratic Treasury Secretary, talking about how the Bush administration was too slow in responding to this financial crisis. And he also has some pretty strong views about how much inequality has risen and how the tax code needs to be changed, essentially to raise taxes on the affluent and lower taxes on everyone else, views that are consistent with Obama's. And as Obama's top West Wing aide, I think clearly he's going to have a big presence in this administration.
No, we also have the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, economist and UC Berkeley professor Christina Romer. How are they going to work together?
Well, I think that's the big question about this whole team. It's filled with great people, Christina Romer, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner, and many more. And the big question clearly is, can you get them working together? Not necessarily all going in the same direction. I actually think Obama likes the idea of these people having arguments and him getting to mediate. But it also could be too many cooks.
Let's drop another name in here. The Economic Recovery Advisory Board is going to be chaired by former Fed Chair Paul Volcker. What will the role of that group be, and how might Volcker work alongside Summers and Romer, do you think? Megan?
Well, I think that this is still very much an open question. Certainly, again, Paul Volcker is a name to send soothing thoughts through the hearts of people in the markets because, of course, he's the guy who brought America out of the crippling inflation spiral of the late 1970s.
But brought a lot of Americans to their knees as well, economically.
Well, indeed. And you know, that is one open question, is you sort of have to match the man to the moment. And the skills, not to take anything away from Volcker, but sort of the rock-hard determination that made him an amazing Treasury Secretary at that moment, it's not always clear that's what's needed in every crisis. The other problem is, of course, that no one knows what the role of this group is going to be yet, and you've just thrown yet another giant into the mix. All of these people are going to have their own opinions. They have differing opinions on some crucial issues about how we should go forward. And is Obama going to be able to herd this tribe of cats in a productive direction?
David Leinhardt, the stock market rallied this week after a really awful performance last week. Based on that, can we make any assumptions about how investors are feeling about these teams, or does the Federal Reserve get some of the credit here?
Well, I sort of have a rule that I never try to put too much stock in connecting cause and effect in the markets. I got a lovely email from a reader shortly after the bailout package passed, and in the days after that, the stock market tanked. And the reader pointed out, just imagine if the bailout package had failed and then the markets had done the same thing. We all would have been saying the markets tanked because the bailout failed. And instead, we weren't drawing cause and effect. I do think probably there's some amount of confidence in the markets in the Obama team, but by and large, I think it's important not to draw too much of a conclusion on short-term movements.
Megan McArdle, the Fed's actions this week give you any reassurance?
I think that in a way it's scary because the longer this goes on, the more you realize that there is no sheriff in town. But as a friend IM'd me this week, people love to praise FDR for bold and persistent experimentation, and that's what this looks like. We're in a crisis that is somewhat unprecedented. You know, we've never had one that looked exactly like this. And certainly these big financial crises come along once every 60 years or so. And so it's hard to draw any very firm conclusions about how to deal with them. And so what you're going to get is this incredibly messy response. I think that what the Fed is doing is showing people, and what Treasury is doing, that they're going to keep trying things. And ultimately, hopefully, some of it will stick. We can't sort of test and see what the world would have looked like if we hadn't done any of this.
David Leinhardt of The New York Times and Megan McArdle of The Atlantic, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a nightmare for regional airports feels like a dream to passengers.
It reminds me of Midway back in 1955. There's nobody here. $2 hot dogs, and it's just wonderful. It takes you. There's nobody in security when you go through.
But first, let's do the numbers. If Black Friday means moving out of the red, it was an appropriate day on Wall Street. In a shortened holiday session, the Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 102 points, 1.1% to finish at 8,829. The Nasdaq added 3 points, about 0.25%, to end the day at 1535. The S&P 500 bumped up 8 points, so nearly 1%, to close at 896. For the week, the Dow gained 9.7%. The Nasdaq shot up almost 11%. The S&P 500 rose by 12%. Let's hear a cheer. Citigroup was the big winner today, rising 17.5%. The government bailout of the bank continues to soothe investor fears. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Commerce Department releases the construction spending report for October. The International Monetary Fund meets in Washington to discuss providing help for heavily indebted countries. And it's the 20th anniversary of World AIDS Day. Activists from Australia to Azerbaijan highlight the needs of the 33 million people around the world still living with HIV. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Chrysler isn't saying how many white-collar workers have accepted the company's buyout and early retirement offers. The deadline for their final decision is this weekend. But already the automaker is saying it may still have to make more involuntary layoffs. The company is aiming to eliminate a quarter of its salaried and contract workforces. We've been hearing the layoff headlines every day. It's become a common tactic these days to improve the bottom line and help companies survive through tough economic times. The strain that's putting on American workers is getting a lot of attention. But commentator Amelia Tiagi asks a contrarian question. Are troubled corporations going far enough?
What most people don't realize is that with every mass layoff comes a quiet memo from the top. Hiring freeze, effective immediately. No new employees, no new consultants, no new bodies walking in the door. Period. But this is precisely the wrong moment for hiring freezes. With a stroke of the pen, managers at struggling companies have effectively cut themselves off from fresh perspectives and new ideas, just when they need them most. No, I haven't lost my mind, and I'm not a sadist bent on destroying lives. I'm not talking about simply replacing one warm body with another to do the same old job in the same old way. That would be foolish. Nor am I suggesting that the rank and file should be replaced. Rather, this is a moment when companies should rethink and restructure critical executive jobs, explicitly giving top priority to innovation and change. Try some trade-ins at the top. If a company lays off 30% of the workforce, then at least 30% of the executives should be replaced with new managers. After all, does anyone believe that the same people who ran the company into trouble are exactly the right people to turn things around? Companies should also scrap the part of the memo that forbids any contractors. A downturn is the perfect moment to bring in a few contractors in key positions. You can bring them in for fresh ideas and then send them on when the work is done. Let's face it, in this tough economy, there are some really talented people who are looking for work and who would love to help a struggling company turn itself around. There are also some managers who have been in the same job at the same company for way too long, and the bottom line shows it. So scrap the hiring freeze and make room for real change.
Amelia Tiagi is co-founder and chief operating officer of Business Talent Group. We invite your thoughts at marketplace.org. If you've traveled by air this holiday weekend, you may have already discovered it's not as easy these days to find an easy flight. When times were good, it seemed the airlines would take you anywhere you wanted to go. Small regional airports got a lot of overflow from their big hubs. Here in the L.A. area, there's Burbank, Long Beach, Ontario, Santa Ana. Around New York, there's Islip and Newburgh. But as airlines have cut capacity and routes, many of those smaller airports are suffering. Chicago Public Radio's Adrian Hill reports.
Now stop service from
Chicago Rockford International Airport is clean, bright, airy, and nearly empty. Tom Justin's one of the few passengers in the airport the day I visit. It's easy for him to get help with his bags. He breezes through security in a flash.
It reminds me of Midway back in 1955. There's nobody here. $2 hot dogs, and it's just wonderful. It takes you, there's nobody in security when you go through.
But what's good for the passenger could be bad for the airport. Airlines have cut flights to Rockford. Passenger traffic at the airport fell nearly 75% in September compared to a year ago. It was Rockford's worst month in 5 years.
Make no mistake about it, the economy is affecting everybody.
Bob O'Brien is executive director of Chicago Rockford.
The reality is that across the country, big and small, whether you're O'Hare or Rockford or Dubuque, Iowa, the number of flights were being reduced, the amount of capacity was being reduced.
People are flying less as the recession takes hold. Airlines are cutting routes as their revenues fall and costs rise. Some are going bankrupt, 14 since the end of last year. And when airlines go under or pull out, it can devastate regional airports.
News at 6.
Skybus shut down the low-cost air carrier, closes its...
Gary, Chicago International Airport, just south of Chicago, lost all of its commercial passenger service when Skybus ceased operations in April. The airport gets most of its money now from property taxes and building leases. In Los Angeles, Ontario Airport hit the skids when ExpressJet and JetBlue quit the airport. Other airlines have cut service. Aaron Gelman is a transportation economist at Northwestern University. He says a strong network of regional airports makes it easier for companies to get goods and people from place to place. So when regional airports fail, it's bad for the broader economy.
Mobility in this country is one of the few things that you can identify clearly that accounts for the great success we've had socially as well as economically.
Passenger mobility has dropped off, but the need to transport goods is still giving small airports a lifeline. Chicago Rockford is depending on its cargo business to get it through these bumpy economic times. And O'Brien's confident that passenger traffic will come back.
We're sitting on top of a gold mine. If we can just intercept the people, not from Chicago, but the people that live outside of Chicago that depend upon Chicago here will do well.
He's hoping the airport will double its passenger traffic in 3 years to 500,000. That's still small potatoes compared to an airport like O'Hare, which handles tens of millions of people a year. But it may give Chicago Rockford's security guards a little more to do. In Chicago, I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And a final note following up on an earlier story. If you caught yesterday's program, we paid a visit to a park up the road in Pasadena, California, where a big crowd of volunteers were gathering to serve turkey and all the trimmings to those in need.
Another pie!
Here we got green beans!
Green beans!
As you can hear, there was quite a crowd, and the head of Pasadena's Union Station Homeless Services told us at the time that it just might be a record turnout. Well, we heard from the group after yesterday's program, and they did indeed serve more Thanksgiving meals than they ever have. It all added up to more than 200 turkeys and all the other trimmings, gobbled up by around 6,500 thankful people. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 102 points, 1 1/10%. The Nasdaq gained 3 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 added 8 points, nearly 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up Monday, a fledgling town tries to stay afloat as the economy sinks.
We don't have to lay people off. We can just hire the amount that are needed for our city, because we're a startup city.
I'm Bob Moon. Thanks for joining us. Kai's back on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.